Morning, how are you? I'm impressed. This morning, I was kind of finishing up some sermon stuff and it was raining. I'm like, oh boy, 8:45 is gonna be tough. But you made it, so good job. I'm super happy you're here. If you've been around for any time and heard much about me, you know that I am from Oklahoma. I was born and raised in Oklahoma. I lived there until 6 days after undergrad, and then I moved to Texas. And that's where I met my wife. It's a long, beautiful God story. She worked down there from Iowa, and we lived in Texas for 12 years. It's there we had our kids. And so we lived there for 12 years, and we moved up here. And we have now lived in Iowa together for just over 13 years. And so I'm telling all that story because last week, Matt talked about the stickers on cars in Iowa, right? Like on the back of the cars, you can see Iowa native and Iowa captive. Now you need to know this. In my heart, I'm a little pulled because I'm not native, but I've lived here quite a while and this feels what it is. But so I can't say native, but captive is wrong, right? Like captive seems like you're stuck here and don't wanna be here. That's not my story. Like I love this place. I call it the hidden gem of the U.S. Like, people don't know about Iowa. They keep flying over, and they can keep doing that because it just keeps getting more awesome in Iowa. And so I love this place. I absolutely, I claim it as my home. It feels like this is where we're from. It's from where my wife's family is from. And so feels like a lot of lineage. But there's also sometimes in my moments where I'm sad that my kids don't get to have the experience that I had growing up, right? So the difference is my kids are scared of rednecks and I am fluent in redneck, right? I mean, if you go to like the South in the most ridiculous, like you're gonna be a little nervous, I'm like, that's my people. Like I live there, I know what that's like. They don't know what it's like to go to an OU football game, right? They don't know that kind of idea. There's a lot that they don't know because my kids have never lived in Oklahoma, but that's a part of my story. Even though I've lived a lot of years more than I ever lived in Oklahoma as an adult, there's still parts of me that want it. So here's one of the ways that I've tried to instill Oklahoma in my kids. So growing up, we would always travel to Grandma and Grandpa's house, and Grandma and Grandpa lived in different states, and every time we had to drive to either set of Grandma and Grandpa's, we had to drive either to Oklahoma or through Oklahoma. So early on, when they were little kids, I just did it myself because I'm that guy. But every time we would cross the border into Oklahoma, we would sing the state song. Now, here's the great part about Oklahoma. Oklahoma has a state song that was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein from a huge musical. And so there's like this famous song. If you grew up in Oklahoma, you need to sing it. So I'm going to sing it for you right now. Like, okay. So here's what's gonna happen is we're driving down the road. All three of my kids are in the background and usually you cross the Red River. And all of a sudden, the second we start crossing the river, Dad goes, oh, and then everyone kind of comes in with us, right? Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet. I'm not gonna keep going. But at the end, it's super cool because it goes, O-K-L-A-H-O-M-A, Oklahoma. Okay, and then it's like our car rips into applause, and that's the lineage my kids have to Oklahoma. because they never lived there, right? They've never been there, stayed there. They've driven through there. They kind of sometimes look at my relatives and like, really? And it's like, yep, really. But that's what they know. And you're like, why are you telling this story? Well, I wanted a cameo of singing. Not really. But here's the reason I'm telling the story. I have now lived outside of Oklahoma for 25 years. But I still try to keep my kids engaged with it a little bit. That's my way. But when we pick up the text today in Ezra chapter 2, the people of God have been away from their homeland for 70 years, not 25 years. Now, they tried. They were instructed, even in Jeremiah, to, while they were there, to set up camp, to live and seek the flourishing of the city and try to remain faithful. But while they were gone, they were away from the homeland. We're now two generations who don't know what the streets of Jerusalem are like. Most likely, that second generation wouldn't have spoken. Maybe they spoke with their parents, but that their first language, their most fluent language, wasn't even Hebrew. It was what they spoke in Babylon. Today our text is gonna, it's the immersion when all of a sudden these people who've been gone for 70 years are making their way back to Jerusalem. And here's the topic, here's the name of this sermon, here's the thing that we're gonna keep saying. And so if you wanna check it out and write down, if you're a note taker, this is where you take notes. Hear what we're pushing in today. From cut off captives to covenant connection. From cut off captives to covenant connection. We're gonna be in Ezra 2 if you wanna turn there. I'm gonna read the first verse, but we'll be all over it so you can follow with me if you wanna turn there. But this is Ezra 2. It says, "These now are the people of the province who came from those captive exiles. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had deported them to Babylon. And they returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town." The people of Israel were cut off captives. They had been removed from Jerusalem. They had been in Babylon for 70 years. But the people, the Hebrew people, had a promise of God. In fact, they were in a covenant with him. And this is really important. I'm gonna give you some more history. Pastor Matt went through this last week, but I'm gonna retell it because sometimes the exile in the Old Testament is some of the most massive historical breaks, and understanding it is the most helpful as we try to keep pressing into Ezra 2. But they were cut off captives. They had been taken away and they were coming back. And for us to understand it, we gotta press into this story of covenant. And often when the scriptures in the Old Testament are talking about covenant, it ties in land with it. So I'm gonna kind of retell the story. There was a promise that God gave his people. Exodus 6:8. I mean, guys, we could pull scriptures on all of these all over the place. I'm just gonna try to tell the story a little bit. God had made a covenant and promise with Israel. This is a retelling of that promise in Exodus 6:8. "I will bring you to the land that I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord." God had come to Abraham in Genesis 2 and said, "Abraham, go west. Go find a place. I'm giving you land. You are gonna be my people. And from you, there's gonna be more people from every nation, tongue, and tribe coming from your lineage." There's this promise and it was tied to land. But through the Old Testament, there was a warning because God said, "You're my people and I want you to be me. I want to be your God. But if you don't do that, if you fail on your end, there's gonna be discipline from the Lord." This is an example in Deuteronomy 28:63. This was given in the Pentateuch, a warning of God's gonna give the land, but listen to the warning. "Just as the Lord was glad to cause you to prosper and to multiply you, so he will also be glad to cause you to perish and to destroy you. You will be ripped out of the land you are entering to possess." Right before they're going into the land, he's like, "Listen, all this land you have, it's a blessing, it's a promise for me, but if you get unfaithful to me, I'm gonna remove you from that, remove you from my blessing as a discipline." What we find is it's always to turn the heart of Israel back to him. And if you've read the Old Testament, could they hold their end of the deal very well? No, all the time. Like at every turn, every generation, they're always moving away from God. They didn't listen. Listen to what Jeremiah, a prophet, told them. "This whole land will become a desolate ruin, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. The prophet Jeremiah said, "Listen, God says he's gonna take you out of this land." He's getting really specific now. "You're gonna be pulled out of this land for 70 years and go to Babylon." 586, Nebuchadnezzar shows up, goes down, overtakes Jerusalem, takes all the leaders, all the wealth, all the things from the temple, and moves it to Babylon. They're there for 70 years. That's when you can read the book of Daniel. They're now in Babylon. They're away from their homeland. But then their return was prophesied by Isaiah and Jeremiah. And then we read in Ezra 1:2 from last week, this is what the king of Cyrus, Persia, says: "The Lord, the God of the heavens, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has appointed me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah." This is honestly one of the low-key craziest things that happens in the Old Testament, because there is a very wicked king, Cyrus of Persia, who goes and he takes over Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus comes and overtakes Nebuchadnezzar. And once he gets all these lands, he's like, you know what I want? I want Israel to go back to their homeland and I want them to build a temple. All in line with the prophecy of God, an evil king in the hands of a sovereign God. Unbelievable. So our text today, they start the track back to Judah and Jerusalem. If you're in Ezra chapter 2, there's 70 verses, and somehow in God's humor, I get to preach like 68 verses of descendants. Like, there's a lot going on here, and it's like, what's going on? Like, why are descendants in the scriptures? But here's the thing, in the cultural context, this is actually some incredible signposts for us because it's gonna show the importance of the covenant with the people of God to God. In essence, this whole chapter is highlighting the importance of the covenant between God's people and God. And the way it's written, it's almost showing receipts. Like, these people belong to the covenant and they belong to be there and to go back and to build what matters. So from cut-off captives to covenant connection, we're gonna rock through some history and some people, and I'm gonna give you some application. You guys ready to go? Beautiful. You made it through the historical intro. All right, I'm gonna read back again Ezra 2. These now are the people of the providence who came from those captive exiles King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had deported to Babylon. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each in his own town. And then this is the first wave. We're gonna have a list of people going back to Jerusalem. And there's two kind of major lists and there's minor lists in each of them. The first list is the deported people, the documented people of God. These are people who had receipts, who could prove their lineage to the covenant. And it starts with key leaders, Ezra 2:2. They came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reliah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Baana. I think you should clap for the record. It wasn't my best, but it was not bad. Here's the thing. These are the massive leaders of this movement. There's multiple deportations from Babylon back to Israel. You see Ezra, you see Nehemiah, and these are the people who are giving key leadership to make this happen. And so oftentimes we read the Bible like, okay, there's a few leaders and they're hard to pronounce, and then we move forward. Hear me say this. They are key leaders who are giving spiritual guidance, but also administrative ridiculousness to make this happen. To go from Babylon to Jerusalem is somewhere between 800 and 900 miles. It is a 4-month trek if you're walking. If you're walking, so when they're listing all of these people, this is a significant move that these leaders went into Babylon and said, I think you should come with me. I know it's gonna be long. I know it's gonna be hard. Come with me. And at the end of month one, they convinced people not to turn back and go to Babylon. Like, this is a significant move. There's a quick application here. We're gonna have a lot of these as we move along. What's God calling you to lead? I'm pretty sure none of us in this room are ever gonna lead 50,000 people. None of us are gonna like get people in rag-bri fashion to go 800 to 900 miles, right? None of us are gonna do that. But can I just tell you, God's put you in places of leadership somewhere in your life. Maybe I know it's in your family. Like, where's God asking you to do some leadership? Maybe it's at Keystone. Maybe it's in the community somewhere. But I just love that the reality of when God does something, he always raises up leaders. Are you stepping into the things that God's calling you to do? I know a lot of people sometimes that have dreams, and sometimes we say that they're just dreams, but they're actually just turned off voices of God that we know he wants us to do something, and we just don't do it. It goes from like the key leaders, the Nehemiahs, the Zerubbabels. We'll read all about them. But it then moves to lay leaders. And these are, it's like a huge list. From verse 23 to 35, there's this massive list of lay leaders. It starts like this in verse 2. And they came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, you saw those people. And then it skips in half that verse. It says, the number of the Israelite men included Parash's descendants, 2,172. Shephatiah's descendants, 372. Arah's descendants, 775, and it keeps going. And there's this list, there's this huge list all the way through verse 35 is a list, and it just gives a name and the number of descendants all throughout. But this list is broken up in two ways that's really tied to the covenant and really matters. But beginning in verse 3 through 20, it actually communicates descendants. If you look at your book, if you look at your scriptures, you're going to say all the way through verse 20, it's like Alter's descendants, Bezalel's descendants, and it gives a number. But then if you look at verse 21 through 35, it no longer is connected to a person, right? It's no longer connected to a person. It's connected to land, a town, a geography. And the idea here is that some of the people were really tied to descendants of key people in the Hebrew nation, and others were tied to town. They had records of their land. And so through 21 through 35, you see the connection to the land. Verse 21, it starts like this, Bethlehem's people, 123. And then it lists the different types of people that were from Bethlehem. Nephoth's men, Anathoth's men. And it gives numbers. And it lists people that are coming from that line. Here's what's interesting about this. I think it's interesting because clearly in genealogical and ancient times, even in modern times, we often give the lineage through the man's line. But we read these names, and again, I think we get kicked up on names, and if you're in your Bible through a year program, and you've done that, you know as well as I do, you skim these sections, right? And we go, yeah, we're skimming past it, but if you just pause for a little bit, look what's happening here. Here's this man, a name that we don't know. You'll never know him, I'll never know him, and then there's a number of people that are following them. Generations matter. If we think of our lives, like I think of my kids and eventually one day I'll think about my grandkids, and then we kind of just turn it off like we're gonna be dead, we're not gonna really know them. But did you know that a couple who are married and they have an average number of kids and they all get married and they have an average number of kids, and by the way, only 90% of people get married. So it's like if you just follow that math, two people being married by the time there's great grandkids, has turned into 50 to 75 kids. It could be way more than that. And here we see the power of generations and descendants. The man's name and saying, after time, look at the number of people that they impacted. Let's get really practical with this application. I'm gonna read from you two studies, one from Europe and one from the United States. This first one was written from Switzerland. And this is his statements. If the father doesn't attend church, only 2% of children become regular worshipers, even if the mother attends regularly. Next, if the father attends regularly, regardless of the mother, about 2/3 to 3/4 of children attend church as adults. Dads, are you listening? So we're reading strange men's name, and then we see a huge number after it. I'm telling you, in Switzerland and also in the U.S., the way a father leads their family categorically changes how they interact with the gospel and how they interact with faith. I'm gonna read the studies from the United States. When both parents attend Sunday school, that's a way to say in the study that they were more committed. They didn't just come to church every now and again, but that they were fully engaged. They were engaged in the life of the church. We would say connection groups. When both parents attend, like are super engaged, not just come to church every now and again, 72% of children continue in their faith when they're adults. When only the father attends, 55% stick around. When only the mother attends, 15% do. And if neither parent attends, around 6% of the kids stay involved in the faith. Now listen, these are statistics, and I actually break the statistics. So don't let a statistic tell your story. But fathers, how many descendants are gonna be on the right side of your name in 4 to 5 to 6 generations? Are you leading in a way that's gonna set pace for your kids to be engaged? There's a song by a girl named Sarah Groves, and I love it. It's called Generations, and this is what it says. Remind me of this with every decision. Generations will reap what I sow. I can pass a curse or a blessing to those I will never know. Here are heads of families tied to the covenant, tied to lands of the covenant, and look at the number of people that are following them because they've stayed faithful. Are you staying faithful? Those are the leaders. There's the key leaders, there's the lay leaders, and now we're on to the ministry leaders. The ministry leaders. The next on the list is so when you're gonna go back to the city, you gotta bring all the people, but the people were going back because they were tied to the covenant, but the center of covenant life for the Israel people is the temple. It's where they worshiped God. It's where they had connected. The temple is the center of their covenant with God. It's because where they came to worship. It's where they came to make sacrifices so they could be at peace with God. It's not just like, oh, they wanted to go to church. It's like the only way for them to have good connection with God is for their sins to be paid for by the sacrifices of the system. And this had been removed from them for 70 years. 70 years, no one had gone to the temple. For 70 years, there had been no sacrifices to atone for their sins. There's 70 years of bent up, we need to meet with God. I don't know if you remember this, but in 2020, when COVID happened, we had to shut down church, and it was like Easter Sunday was online. Remember how terrible that was? And so Easter comes, and there's like, I don't know the numbers, but we weren't waiting for 70 days or 70 years. It was more like 70 days that we waited. And pretty soon, right after COVID hit, we saw an opportunity and we had church at the band shell at Hawkeye Park. Did anyone was there? Anyone was there? Just a few. Here's what was crazy. We hadn't met together in worship for so long. And we all went to this little grass field, and the city, in their kindness, had drawn circles that each family could be in there. For the record, this was before COVID got crazy. This was when it was still like people were dying a lot. And I remember the tears when we got to meet together. The joy, because we hadn't met together as a church. And here, the people have not worshiped God at his place of worship for 70 years. They are going up, and they know that when they go back to Jerusalem, it's not just so that they can re-enter their house, it's so they can build the house of God and worship him. And so in this covenant, they want to build what matters, so they talk about the ministry leaders who are a part of that. So we start with the priest. The priest were of the tribe of Levi, but they had direct descendants from Aaron, and they were responsible for all the sacrifice. The high priest, the number one priest, would enter the Holy of Holies once a year on the Yom Kippur and make the sacrifices. Ezra 2:36 talks about the priest. It says, the priests included Judah, and I'm not gonna read the names, and it gives numbers. And here's what's interesting about this list. There's four families named in the list of priests who came back. Four families. That's unique, and it's actually somewhat some bad news. That's only four families of the 24 families that David had appointed. So you only see 17% of the families coming back that were in the priesthood. Not all of them came back. Some of them stayed. Now the good news is it was 10% of all the people who came back. But the idea here is that God's saying, what is important is worship, and the priests are showing up. And then it mentions Levites. Verse 40 says the Levites included Jeshua, and it gives the list of names. Now Levites, this is really interesting. This is kind of some Bible trivia. Hear this. All priests were Levites, but not all Levites are priests. So Levites were in the tribe of Levi, but they weren't direct descendants of Aaron. And the Levites' responsibility in the temple was that they would do, like, kind of clean up. They would prepare the sacrifices. They couldn't do the sacrifices. They were kind of like operations of the temple, as it were. What we see here, even though so many priests come back, only 74 Levites returned. In chapter 8, Ezra comes in, and he could only get 35 Levites to come with him. And so in the midst of all these numbers, again, it's a descendants, it's hard to kind of go through. Why in the world are there so few Levites who are coming back? It's a great question, and I think it has a lot to do with us as well. The Levites, when they were given the land, Joshua comes to the land, and they divide up all the land in Joshua. The Levites were not given property. Here's the reason why. The idea was, is the Levites had to serve God and they had to trust God for all of their food. They didn't have food if the people didn't tithe, and they didn't have a place to stay unless the people provided. And it was a sense of making them dependent on God. And the idea was many were unwilling. This is what most scholars believe. Many of them were unwilling to go back because they did not know their future. They didn't know if they would have land, and they didn't want to make the trek because they didn't know what would happen. Can we just push that into our lives today, brother and sister? This is an observation I've made so many times. People stop following God when it stopped making sense. When you're like, I'm not sure what's next. When following God goes from a ritual we do on Sunday to faith I have to have in my life to depend on him and trust in him to do what he says, that's when so many people go, ugh, I'm out. So my question for you is there something God is calling you, but it's not making sense right now, so you're digging in your feet and not following him? So what was happening with the Levites. You move forward. There's the gatekeepers. Ezra 2:42, the gatekeepers' descendants included Shalom's descendants, and it keeps going. These were Levites as well, but their job was to guard each gate in Jerusalem and to ensure that no unclean thing came into the city. They were appointed by David. That was kind of a part of the Davidic temple and worship. Then there's temple servants and Solomon's descendants. We don't know a lot about them, but what this word means here is that they're the giving ones or the devoted ones. They're appointed by David and also by Solomon to come in and serve inside the temple. I love all the ministry leaders because when they're going back, they're building what matters. They want to reconnect with God in the temple. Ezra 2, we're seeing people who were cut off captives in Babylon. They're stuck from Babylon. They've been there for 70 years, 2.5 generations removed. And they're going from cut off captives to coming back to Jerusalem and showing their covenant connection in a way that only the Old Testament can, and saying, here's the receipts. These brothers and sisters were part of the covenant. Taking it very seriously. But then we have this unique thing that happens, that there's some undocumented people of God. And this is not a political issue that's in the politics today. This isn't about ethnicity necessarily or nationalism. What this is the people of God trying to be faithful. Look, there were three families and there were three priests and their families who wanted to come back but could not prove that they were connected to God. Listen, look at Ezra 2:59. But they were unable to prove that their ancestral families and their lineage were Israelite. About the three priests, it says, they searched for their entries in the genealogical records, but they could not be found, so they were disqualified from the priesthood. Why is this happening? Here's the reason it was happening. They were trying to be faithful. The temple had a lot of rules. And the people of Israel in their history had so many times where they tried to worship God in the way they wanted and not in the way that God prescribed. And here as they're coming back into Jerusalem, they're like, we're taking this serious. If you're not a part of this covenant, you can't just come into the temple and act like everything's okay. They were trying to be faithful to the point where, we're not gonna read it, but they brought in the Urim and Thummim, which was a way for them to discern through the high priest God's will in a moment. They want to do everything they can to keep the covenant and reconnect with the covenant. And then it goes from the descendants, the verses that you read, that we read when I came up. Here's the first time we really start seeing what happens when all these people come back and connect to God, verse 68. After they arrived at the Lord's house in Jerusalem, some of the family heads gave freewill offerings for the house of God in order to have it rebuilt on its original site based on what they could give. They gave 61,000 gold coins, 6,250 pounds of silver, 100 priestly garments to the treasury for the project. The priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, temple servants, and some of the people settled in their towns, and the rest of Israel settled in their towns. Here's the thing. When you're in covenant with God, and you're willing to follow him 800 to 900 miles to get back to Jerusalem so that you can build what matters, so that the people can reconnect with God, it takes money. Takes money. And the people step up into this reality and they give a free will offering, which means it came from their heart. It wasn't prescribed by the law. They just came and said, this is what we're gonna do. I did the math. In all of what is described here, there's 1,133 pounds of gold. That would be about $30 million in today's dollars, and 6,300 pounds of silver, about $3.7 million. Somewhere around $33 to $34 million is today's value of that gold. They walk in, and they're like, God, we got to build what matters. And for us to rebuild this thing, it takes resources, and so we're willfully, freely giving that would happen. And there's two words here that I want to put in front of you that I think it will challenge. It's challenged me. I hope it challenges you. There's two words in here. Verse 68 says, some of the family heads gave free will offerings. Some. It doesn't say not. It doesn't say all. It doesn't say most. It says some. Some gave. Some things never change. This is true in modern times. For those who are connected to the God, now listen, if you're not a Christ follower, we're not talking about money. We're not talking about you giving. You don't know Jesus, it's totally fine, right? And if Keystone's not your home, we're not talking to you either. But if Keystone is your home, there's so many. There is a lot of people here who give free will offerings to build this building, to pay staff, to have their youth ministry, to have Salt Company, to send mission trips, all of these things. We freely give all of that stuff. But the reality in a church, in modern world, just like it was in ancient worlds, is some give, not all. There's another word in here. It's not just the word some. It's the word could. It says, some of the family heads gave free will offerings for the house of God in order to have it rebuilt on its original site. Listen, based on what they could give. Based on what they could give. Look what it says. It says what they could give. It does not say what they wanted to give. Please hear this. When it comes to your giving, your could should be bigger than your want. I don't know about you, but I want a lot of material things. I want this, I want that. I'd love a new car. I want this. I want that. And I think a lot of people come to giving with what they want to give. And what's interesting here is the text says that these families who gave, they gave what they could give. You need to know this. Most of us could give more. We just don't want to. We've made spending choices in our lives that make it way more difficult for us to give. And we actually let what we spend determine how much we give. We're like, if I have a little extra of the month, then I'll throw that in and I'll help. Because I do love God. I do love that. But what he's saying is they're starting with what they could. We're going to start, what can we give? Not based on what's over, but we're pressing in. It's not what they want to do. And please hear this. This isn't because some pastor got up and guilted you into giving to the church. This is categorically their first step when they show up and are reconnecting to God and rebuilding the temple so they can connect with God. This is their first step. They want to build what matters, and if they're going to build it, they have to give free will offerings to make it happen. From cutoff captives, they've been gone a long time, 70 years. And when they come back, they're making the trek and they show up, and the first thing they do is they cannot wait to rebuild the temple. And so they're just giving sacrificially to make it happen. So how does this connect with us? Like Pastor Brent, we are not Israel. We're not stuck in Babylon. We don't worship at a temple. We live in Ankeny and we come to an air-conditioned building, right? I go, well, how in the world? I mean, I get it. You're making some good points throughout the way. How does this connect with us? This is Galatians 3, 7 through 9. Because what we find is that we are a part of the covenant, not because of our lineage that we read about, but because of our faith. This is Galatians 3, 7 through 9. You know then that those who have faith, these are Abraham's sons. Now the scriptures saw in advance God would justify the Gentiles by faith and proclaim the gospel ahead of time. Abraham saying, all the nations will be blessed through you. Consequently, Those who have faith are blessed with Abraham who had faith. The idea here is, brothers and sisters, we've been grafted into this promise. We can be God's people, not because of our descendants, not because of our land, but because of our faith. And so when we read this book, we need to remember, because of our sin, we were cut off. And the way that we become covenantal in covenant connection with God is now long over making the trek because of my grandpa, because he owns some land. And so now we got to rebuild the temple so we can reconnect with God. The scriptures in the New Testament says that all happens when we bow the knee to by faith and say, God, I believe in you. And we're now engrafted into God. And so I want to end our time today with asking this question. Are you on the list? Are you on the list? For our salvation, this is not a genealogical thing. This is a faith thing. And we actually see that in Revelation that there's a book that our names are written in if we've accepted Christ. And so have you believed in faith? I don't know your lineage. I don't know your story. I don't know whether you're Oklahoma, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota. Doesn't matter. What matters is faith in Christ Jesus. But then, let's ask a more astute question. Many in this room, you're on the list with salvation. Your name is written in Heaven's Book of Life. But are you living more out of your captivity or your covenant? In my mind, it's so easy to stay distracted. I once heard someone say this: history doesn't repeat itself, but human nature does. So there's not gonna be another Hitler, but there's gonna be another dictator, right? And when we read this story, what's one of the most unbelievable thing is that only a minority came back to Jerusalem. The majority of the Jewish people have forgotten the importance of their covenant, forgot the importance of worshiping God. They got busy being distracted in Babylon, and they never returned. And so for those of you who know Christ in this room, and your name's on the list, are you living your life in such a way that you're running to your connection to God? You're building what matters most in His kingdom? Or are you just distracted in Babylon? Life is complicated. Lots of things we have to do. So easily to be distracted. But are you a part of the distracted majority, or are you a part of the devoted minority that's on the list? They remembered their connection with God. They walked back so that they could stay connected with Him, and they built what matters. Would you pray with me? God, this morning, I'm confident there's some people in this room that they're not on the list. They don't have a relationship with you. Maybe they're, if that's you, when you're asking questions, you know, we're so happy. You're honored in this place. We're ready to answer your questions, but we love you enough to say, brother and sister, listen, the most important step you could take in your life is to make a profession of faith in Christ Jesus that only He can save you. And join that covenant, not because of a lineage, but because of the work of Christ. But then if you're on that list and your name is written in the book of life, brother and sister, are you distracted in Babylon? Or are you returning to the heart of your covenant, worshiping God, building what matters most in your life and for others as well? Lord, thank you that through Christ, the invitation is to go from a cut-off captive to covenant connection. Thanks for a story in the Old Testament that challenges us, God, to stay connected with you and to build what matters most.